Okay, we'll continue with the afternoon program, which will start off with a presentation by Dr. Raymond Taillefer from I'll do my best on this, Hospital du Haut-Richelieu in Montreal, Canada. Ray is a very experienced person in all aspects of radionuclide imaging, so I think you'll find him very informative and instructive. He will start off the afternoon sessions with a presentation reviewing the production and quality control of radiopharmaceuticals.
Thank you very much, Lindsay. I would like first to thank the members of the organizing committee for inviting me. This is a real honor and pleasure to be here. And although the first presentation may seem far from clinical practice, I'm going to try to stay focused on the clinically relevant questions regarding production of radionuclides, and I will try to cover the majority of the questions that you may have when you're going to have your exam on this specific topic. So I'll try to cover the most important part of the production of radionuclides, the radioisotope generators that we use in clinical practice, preparation of radiopharmaceuticals, their quality control, and review some of the basic characteristics of a technetium cold kit that we use in nuclear cardiology practice. So as you know, we basically can have access to radiotracer from three different sources. We can separate that into primary sources, nuclear reactor and cyclotron, and also the secondary source, the generator. So some of you may use a unit dose that will come directly from a company using generator or cyclotron, and some of labs will use kits that you're gonna use in your own lab. So we're gonna try to cover all these aspects. So the first thing is if we use, for example, technetium, most of them are being produced with generator, molybdenum generator, and this molybdenum will come from a nuclear reactor, from a nuclear bombardment. So basically what we do, it's very simple, is that we're going to hit a stable atom with subnuclear particles, for example, neutrons, protons, alpha particles, etc., and that will give, after that, the molybdenum that we're going to use. So we can separate that into reactor and linear accelerator or high-energy cyclotron and also low-energy cyclotron. So for example, all the molybdenum and technetium that we are using, the majority of them will be produced by a reactor. Also in nuclear medicine, we use iodine-131, phosphorus, etc. Thallium will be produced from a linear accelerator, and this is the common use. So this is why when we had a problem in Canada a few years ago regarding the molybdenum reactor, we were still able to use thallium because it's not produced by reactor, but rather by a accelerator. And of course, low energy cyclotron, fluorine, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, are being produced by a low-energy cyclotron that you can have in your hospital or nearby. This is just to give you a hint on how we summarize the production of radionuclide, and this is something you might see in questions. So this is the equation of production of radiotracer. So the first part is the target. So that will be the target that we will bombard with a particle. In this example here, P is a proton. So by having this target, we're going to bombard with proton, and then we will have emission of particles. In this case, it will be two neutrons, and then we're going to have the final product. So all agents that are produced, all the radiotracer that will be produced, we always use the same kind of equation. Very simple, four parameters: target, the bombarding particle, the emitted particle, and then the final product. Now, if we look at the production of radioisotopes with the reactor, again, I told you that most of the molybdenum that we are using these days are produced after nuclear fission. So we will bombard a uranium-235 target with one neutron that will give uranium-236, and that will be split into molybdenum and also stein, and then it will give neutron. So this is what we want to have to have our production of molybdenum. There are two different ways. In fact, there are many ways to do molybdenum, but basically we have the fission, as I told you before, or we can use neutron capture. By neutron capture, what we do is that we will have a target of molybdenum 98. We will bombard with neutron. Then we will have emission of gamma ray, and it will give molybdenum 99. So if we use that kind of production in a smaller cyclotron, it costs less to prepare, but the problem is that the specific activity is very small, approximately 75 millicurie per milligram. So the it's not a very good specific activity, and the concentration will be lower. If you compare to fission, by bombarding uranium-235, it costs more to prepare, but we have a much higher specific activity in the range of 500 curies per milligram. We use a smaller column, less shielding, and we will obtain higher concentration. So this is why commercially available molybdenum-99 will come from fission instead of neutron capture. There are many places in the world where we can produce or molybdenum with reactors, and one of the source of the problem was Canada 2 years ago, or even last year. And this is a problem when we have only few sites preparing, using these reactors to prepare molybdenum 99. But now the major advantage is that several countries are starting to use their own molybdenum, so probably we will not see the same problem we were facing a few years back anymore. Now, the processes of molybdenum technetium generator, as I told you, so we will bombard uranium, and that will give molybdenum 99, but also some impurities. So what we have to do is to make sure that the level of impurities is very low, and there are some parameters that we must, not us specifically the clinicians, but the vendors who will use these reactors, they must be sure that we have a very high specific activity, but also that the amount of iodine-131 is less than 0.05 microcurie, and the same thing for ruthenium and other strontium, etc. So there are some impurities, but the goal is to make sure that these impurities are beyond a certain level that is well known by the companies. So now for the preparation of radiopharmaceuticals, the definition of a radiopharmaceutical is as following. This is a radionuclide which will be used as a tracer in medicine, presented in a specific chemical form which control its biological fate when administered to the patient. So this is the technical definition of radiopharmaceutical. The first thing is the extraction of the radionuclide from the bulk of the target substance. So it can be either generator or it can be from a reactor. After that, we have purification of this tracer to remove any unwanted chemical or radionuclide impurities, and we will go through all these impurities in the next few minutes. Now, we need to do chemical conversion of the pure radionuclide into a biological specific form. So for example, sometimes we can use pertechnetate coming from the generator, but we have to label it, for example, with system EB if we want to have system EB. So this is the chemical conversion. Then we have to, in some cases, and we will review them later, addition of the necessary excipient to make the preparation suitable for administration to the patient. And of course, testing the quality of the final product. Some of them, it's the responsibility of the radionuclide company, but some of them is our responsibility in our labs. So I will review the responsibility on our side. So of course, you all know about the molybdenum technetium generator. Basically, what we want is to apply short-lived radionuclide restricted to a place close to its source. Because if you use a radionuclide coming from outside, it might take too much time to receive it. So we need to have a generator on site, which will provide us with the agent that we need. And of course, the shorter the half-life, the closer to the source are the practical limits. So the principle of the generator is the following. We need to have a parent radionuclide, which will usually be a long-lived radionuclide, that will decay to form a daughter, which is a short-lived radionuclide. So parent with long life, which will give birth to the daughter with short life. And also we need to have a suitable means for separating the two species, because it's good to have the two species in the same generator, but we must find a way that will be very easy to separate the parent from the daughter from the parent. And of course, the parent must be transportable or very easily transportable to give birth, if you want, to the daughter radionuclide. So the parent radioisotope will be bound to a matrix, and the parent isotope will decay to its daughter. So we have the parent here, the molybdenum 99, which will give technetium. And then we must be able to elute this generator to have the daughter readily available at the end of the process. So the molybdenum technetium is the most important generator that we use in clinical practice. Again, I told you that we mostly use uranium fission with neutron, but again, we can use molybdenum 98 bombarded with neutron, or even molybdenum 100 bombarded with proton that will give also molybdenum. So these are the three most important way to produce molybdenum, but again, uranium is the first one. The advantage is that, of course, we have a daily access to technetium with a short half-life of 6 hours. So we can have, from the generator, we can have this technetium available on a constant basis. And the advantage of the molybdenum 99 is that the half-life is 66 hours. That means that every week we can have the generator. For example, in our lab, we receive the generator on Sunday morning, and then we can start elution. And this generator will be good for at least 1 week, sometime 8 days. But the half-life of the molybdenum is 66 hours. And then we can extract the technetium by simple column chromatography, and I will explain how we do that. So radioactivities from both molybdenum 99 and technetium are continually changing within the generator. The molybdenum level will decrease by radioactive decay. So this is a constant decay, again, 66 hours. So we know precisely the decay of molybdenum 99. But the level of technetium will be influenced by both the growth and the decay effects. So it depends on how many technetium we will milk from the generator versus the decay of the molybdenum. So the level of technetium is relatively complex, and it's related to exponential function of time. And this is what we call a transient equilibrium. So I will show you a display of that. So here we have the decay of molybdenum, very stable throughout the time that we're going to use this generator. Again, half-life of 66 hours. And then, of course, when we have decay of molybdenum, we have increase of technetium, which will last depending on the half-life of 6 hours. So if we don't use the generator, our technetium will decrease because we're not using it. And of course, if we use it, then it will decrease and re-increase again throughout the week when we are using this generator. Now, how can we separate the technetium from the molybdenum? This is based on the difference in the physical or chemical properties of molybdenum and technetium. And basically what we do use is a column chromatography. because molybdenum is immobilized on alumina column. So very quickly, the molybdenum will stay fixed within the generator on this alumina column, and then the technetium, the pertechnetate that we're going to have at the end, will just go through this column, and then we're going to be able to elute the generator because the molybdenum will remain fixed onto that column. So what we do need to do is a saline solution through the column that will remove or elute the technetium as sodium pertechnetate solution. So from the molybdenum that we have, then it will decay into pertechnetate, and this pertechnetate will go through the column and will not remain fixed into the generator. There is another way to do that. This is a gel generator. The column is amorphous zirconium molybdate, but this is not a very frequent, but this is another way to do that. So this is an example here of a schematic representation of the generator. So we have a saline solution that will go through, and then we have the molybdenum here, the column, and then the molybdenum will remain fixed here while pertechnetate will just go through, and then we're going to be able to have all this pertechnetate activity in the other side of the generator. So this is a very simple process because of the difference in the ionic charge. We often use the terminology related to alumina column for generators, and instead of saying eluting, we always say we're going to milk the generator, because this is really the same kind of process. But we have the eluent, the eluate, the ion exchange column, which is the alumina column, fractional elution, I will come back later, specific concentration, and of course the efficiency of elution. So this is just to show you that we often think that these generators are very big. In fact, they're very small. It's about 1 foot high. And this is the column. So this is the system that we're going to use. And if you compare to a pencil, you can see that this is relatively small. And this is how we do that. So we have the alumina column here. Oops. So this is the system that we have. And this system is the bulk, is the really the matrix of the generator. All the rest will be only shielding. You can see the shielding here, the lead shielding. So when you receive the generator, it's again very small. You have the saline charge here, and then we have the place to connect. So basically, we will put saline solution here. It will go through the alumina column, and then it will go back here into the connection so that we can remove the molybdenum 99. So what kind of quality control? Because as you can see, there are many steps in the process of doing this. And every step has its drawbacks, or we have to make sure that we have a very good quality control procedure. So basically by the manufacturer, we ask them to look at the sterility of the agent, pyrogene free, and I will come back later, and radionuclide contaminants in molybdenum 99. So they must be sure that they follow the rules, and then we're going to have less than X number of millicurie or microcuries of various impurities that they're going to receive from the reactor. And by the user, after each elution, that means by user, we means us. So every time we receive a dose, if we do that in our own lab, or if you have that from central radiopharmacy, the central radiopharmacy, we'll have to check for molybdenum 99 radionuclide impurity. We'll have to check for alumina present in the eluate, and also to check for any hydrolyzed reduced technetium, what we call the technetium O2. And I will show you some example. Now, what kind of quality control can we do that to the final eluate that we have after reconstruction of the generator? Again, molybdenum breakthrough, other radionuclide contamination, but most importantly, the aluminum breakthrough. So generator using fission-produced molybdenum, again, this is the majority. The USP, the United States Pharmacopeia limits, is for iodine-131 less than 0.05 microcurie per millicurie. Same thing for strontium, etc. And that must be at the time of injection. So at the time of injection, so at the time that we will inject the patient with the radionuclide that we just received, we must be sure that we respect these USP limits, and this is done by your vendor, your local radiopharmacy. We can also use a multi-channel pulse height analyzer, and this is again performed by manufacturer. So this is not a real issue for you, but sometimes you can see that some generator will be withdrawn by the FDA, and this is because related to these contaminants to the molybdenum. So this is why they have to check for each system. Each time you have a batch of molybdenum 99, you have to check for these impurities. So the molybdenum breakthrough can happen sometime. So that will originate from the small quantity of molybdenum that will be eluted with the technetium. I told you that the majority of molybdenum will remain fixed onto the column of alumina, but sometime you can have some degree of breakthrough. And you don't want that, because if you have that, that means that you will inject your patient with molybdenum 99 and it will increase the radiation dosimetry. Usually it will go into the liver, so you're going to have a liver uptake because of your molybdenum presence. So the USP limits for molybdenum 99 is 0.15 microcurie of molybdenum per millicurie of technetium. It's relatively easy to detect because the gamma energy of molybdenum is very high, 740 and 780 keV photon if you compare to 140 for technetium. So it's very simple to detect. We can use a dose calibrator. So if you have your own generator in your lab, this is what you have to do. So it's very, again, simple. By dose calibrating, we can assess the molybdenum activity. Or we can use colorimetric tests. So we just add some chemical component, and then we're going to have a color change. That means that you have molybdenum into your molybdenum contamination into your final eluate. So this is something that we have to evaluate. So this is the way. So for example, we know that with technetium and the 140 keV gamma rays, if you have a lead pot with 6 millimeter thickness, then you will stop most of the activity coming from technetium. However, you will not stop the gamma rays coming from the molybdenum, and then you're going to be able to detect that. Now, the most important one is the aluminum breakthrough. This is something that we often see in generators. So, of course, in the generator, we have molybdenum, but we also have the column. And this alumina column, also we can see some degree of breakthrough. So the problem with that, it's not radiation dosimetry to the patient, but it will interfere in the preparation of various radionuclides. So for example, if you do a MAGA study and you have too much activity with your alumina, then you will decrease the labeling efficiency of your red blood cell. The same thing for sulfur colloid. If you have alumina, then it will change the biological or biodistribution of your radiotracer. And of course, you don't want that. And the USP limits for alumina will be less than 10 microgram of aluminum per ml that you inject, again, at the time of injection. And we use a very simple colorimetric test. And if you have an excessive amount of aluminum, then you're going to have a lack of stability of the column too. So that means that if you have too much aluminum in your column, in your generator, you have to replace your generator. That means that it's unstable, so you must call your vendor and they will take it back because they have to also do tests on it. And the pH, usually the pH that we use that is acceptable varies between 4.5 to 7.5. The majority of them will be around 6.5 to 7. Now for the chemical impurity, to detect the alumina presence, it's to use this paper. This is a colorimetric test. And if you have too much aluminum, this is the aluminum ion, Al plus 3, then you're going to have a pink coloration instead of the standard white. So this is very easy to do, just one drop on this colorimetric test. Now let's talk about the technetium cold kit and how we do the quality control also on these agents. Of course, having technetium cold kit is very, very convenient, because that means that you can for example, buy vials for 1 year, and then you just need to have your technetium. Then you have to inject your technetium into these vials, but you're always sure to have a certain amount of radiotracer always available. So this is very convenient, either in a central radiopharmacy or in your lab. So when you have that in your lab, and this is what I prefer, that means that we can do every test every day because we always have access to these radiotracer. This is especially good in the general nuclear medicine department, not necessarily in nuclear cardiology, but I'm a nuclear medicine physician, so we're doing also other tests than cardiac studies. So it's very convenient if you do lung studies, heart studies, bone studies, so we always have access to these agents. So basically, it consists into a glass vial with very specified quantities of reagents, and usually it will be freeze-dry. That's very important because this is how we're going to have a stable agent, which will be good for several months and sometime up to 1 year. Most of the tracer will have a long shelf life, usually more than 12 months. So if you do that, be very careful when you receive these kits to make sure that the shelf life is effectively 1 year. So you have to look at the date. This is very important. The majority of reducing agent, because we need that to change the ionic charge of pertechnetate, we're going to need some tin, stannous chloride. Some of them will contain antioxidant, either ascorbic or gentisic acid. That's very important because if it comes oxidized, it will be hydrolyzed, and then when we do the study, the labeling, it will change the quality of labeling. And then, of course, in some agent, we have to do some reducing from oxidation state, so from 7 to lower oxidation state, or either 3 or 4. It depends, again, on the agent that you're going to use. But in nuclear cardiology, this is less a significant problem. So this is a typical reagent vial or kit, if you want. So you have a rubber septum, and then you have usually vacuum, so either it's totally empty or it will be into nitrogen atmosphere. And then you have your powder, your usually white powder, which will contain your technetium complex, the ligand, the reducing agent, and the antioxidant. So you don't have to mix them yourself. It's already done in the freeze-dry preparation. But now, of course, we have to do some quality control. So you have to check that your vial, that the component that you have is effectively what you want to inject to your patient. So there are several steps to that. So the radiochemical purity is defined as the fraction of the total radioactivity in the desired chemical form in the radiopharmaceutical. So radiochemical impurities arise from decomposition that can be due to either the action of solvent, the change in temperature or the pH of your reaction, oxidizing or reducing agents, or radiolysis or light. So some of the radiotracer can be very sensitive to that. So you want to make sure that you're going to have the good radiochemical purity. So by assessing radiochemical purity, we want to see if we have some free pertechnetate, because if you inject system EB and you have free pertechnetate, we accept usually 90%. So if the labeling efficiency is more than 90% for the specific agent that you want to inject into your patient, it's good. If it is less than 90%, then you can see some free pertechnetate, then you're gonna see thyroid, you're gonna see stomach, and of course it will interfere with your reading. So this is very important to have a high radiochemical purity agent. So we are looking at free pertechnetate, we're looking at hydrolyzed technetium, and there are a number of analytical methods that we can use. We can use precipitation, paper thin layer gel chromatography, paper gel electrophoresis, or high performance chromatography. But in clinical practice, we don't have the time to do all these methods. So the favorite one, if again you are using your own generator system, is to use a paper thin layer chromatography, which is very simple, takes only a few minutes, and is very convenient. So how do we do that? It's very simple. We use what we call the ascending chromatography principle. So by that is that we have a plate, it's a paper column. It depends on the agent. It depends on what you want to assess. But on this plate, what we put, we have a origin. So we put some, like one drop of your agent. And then you have solvent here. And the solvent will migrate. And depending on the system that you're using, depending on the agent that you're using, then you're going to be able to separate the agent that you want to inject versus the free perticlinate or dehydrolyzed or reduced perticlinate. So just an example here. So we have the solvent front, we have our radiochemical here, and then the origin. So we have the species that we put. And then depending on the rate here of progression of the agent, we're going to be able to see if we have or not any impurities. So this is very simple, but you don't have to learn that by heart. There are so many systems that it's very difficult, but it's very easy. Again, the principle is just that we place a drop on this paper, and then we just follow at the end. We cut that into two pieces, and we measure the activity. And by doing so, we're going to be able to see if we have impurities or not. And again, this is radiochemical impurity. So this is modification of your technetium status. Instead of having perticlinate, for example, we can have unlabeled or not properly labeled radiotracer. We can also use electrophoresis chamber. This is the same principle. So we have a support, then we apply a certain current, and this current will make the radiotracer, and then we're going to be able to separate those at the origin versus at the front of the plate. So this is for radiochemical purity, but we also have the chemical purity. I told you that one of the problems is the aluminum that we can see. So this is aluminum is not radioactive, so this is why we call it chemical impurity instead of radiochemical impurity, which is a different status of your technetium perticlinate. So the chemical purity is defined as a fraction of the material in the desired chemical form. So you want to have, for example, make sure that you don't have any contamination. And the principal undesirable chemical contaminant in the generator will be the aluminum. There are also some biological tests that we can do according to specific laws. We have to check the sterility. So, of course, all preparation must be sterilized. And also the aperogenicity. We want to make sure that there is no pyrogen. And pyrogen is a polysaccharides or proteins, if you want. And if your patient receives those pyrogens, then they're going to have chills, malaise, fatigue, nausea. It's like flu-like symptoms. And there are different tests to do that. Many companies will use rabbit tests, or you have the limulus test, amebocyte, which is very simple. This is red blood cells from a horseshoe crab, and then that will react with the pyrogen very quickly, and this is a way that you can see that. But this is not something that we're going to do on a usual clinical practice basis, unless you're using your own lab to label red blood cells or white blood cells, then you have to do that. But not in nuclear cardiology, this is not something that we are doing. I will skip that. So we have various kits that are available. Basically, if you are using technetium labeled system, then you're going to have system EB and tetrafosmin. So for system EB, this is what it contains. So when you get your vial of system EB, again, the same principle, you have your septum here, and then you're going to have empty nitrogen or empty air, and then you have your white powder. And this white powder, in the case of system EB kit, will contain, of course, methoxyisobutyl isonitrile, copper tetrafluoroborate. Then you have this other compound. So you can see that we have a lot of compounds in this white powder. We have the solubilizing agent and also the reducing agent. But everything is mixed in this white powder. So we just have to put some perticlinate within the vial, then do shake and bake, and it's ready to inject. So usually we're going to be reconstituting with 150 millicurie of perticlinate in 3 mLs. Then we have to boil it for 10 minutes, and then we allow time to cool it down. Then we do our QC control. And the QC is by using Baker Flex aluminum oxide plastic TLC plates. So this is a very common, very standard plate. And then we use ethanol as a solvent phase. And then we will cut into two pieces displayed, and we will measure the activity on both sides, and that will give us the radiochemical purity of the tracer. And again, it must be more than 90% before injecting to the patient. Tetrafosmin, same principle. So in the kit, we have tetrafosmin, we have the reducing agent, we have the chelator, and we have a buffer. So again, everything is included in the white powder. And we can reconstitute with 240 millicurie of pertechnetate in a volume of 8 mLs. And we need to have a venting needle if it's very important for stability, just to remove the extra air. So this is something that must be done. And then we incubate at room temperature for 15 minutes. So we don't have to boil it. It's just wait and see. So we wait 15 minutes. So of course, this is what we have to follow. This is what is written in the package insert. And the same thing for system EB, although it's written 150 millicurie. Those of us who have been involved in the initial research, then this is back in 1985. So that gives my age. We were using more than one curie in the vial, and it remains very, very stable, especially system EB. Every time you have to cook, or you have to cook this agent, every time you have to, you need to have heat to increase your binding forces. Every time you do that, you have a very strong product, so you can inject much more, and that will give a very, very good compound. Now, the QC testing for tetrafosmin, this is the same principle. This is the instant thin layered chromatography, the ITLC, and this is what we have to do. So this is, again, each product has its own method of QC. So this is not one method for all the products. So for example, if you use MDP for bone scanning, you have a very specific method. So each of these radio tracers have their own specific QC procedure. For example, here, instead of using ethanol like we do for MIB, we have to use acetone and also dichloromethane, a mixture, to make sure that we have a good mobilization of the agent. And this requires 20 to 50 minutes to do. So every time, if you have your own lab, your own generator system, and you want to use your own kits, you need for each vial to do that kind of QC. That's very important. Now, I would like to talk initially. How much time do I get? Okay. So initially, I told you about the transient equilibrium in the molybdenum 99 and the technetium generator system. So this is the transient because we have a transient equilibrium between the two agents. But there is another form of equilibrium that we can have in radio tracer that we're using in practice, and this is the secular equilibrium. And in the secular equilibrium, the parent half-life is much, much, much longer than the daughter half-life. With the transient equilibrium, we had 66 hours for molybdenum versus 6 hours for the daughter. So there is just a ratio of 10. But in the secular equilibrium, so the parent activity seems to remain very long throughout the use of the agent, while we have a slight increase of the daughter. And the perfect example of that is the rubidium 82 generator system. So the generator is produced from the parent, and the parent of the rubidium 82 is the strontium 82. And the strontium 82 has a half-life of 25 days, so this is not just a matter of 1 week, it's almost 1 month, while the half-life of your rubidium 82 is only 75 seconds. So you can see the difference between the secular equilibrium versus the transient equilibrium, where the difference is much smaller between the parent and the daughter. So for rubidium, this is a rubidium cation, and I will come back later on that. So, for example, we can use 50 to 60 millicurie, which will be infused over 20 to 30 seconds, instead of the standard 20 to 30 millicuries with technetium. It's because the half-life is so short with 75 seconds that we can even infuse your rubidium 82. So the generator will be useful up to 6 weeks. Usually we say 5 weeks, 4 or 5 weeks, but it can be good up to 6 weeks. And then it's available within 3 months, so this is very simple. And again, half-life of 25 days versus 75 seconds for the rubidium-82. So I think we have, do we have the questions or at the end of the other presentation? At the end of the other presentation? Okay, good. So if it's possible, I would like to have the other presentation.